Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio and the Barley House in Concord, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Legislation that would legalize recreational use of marijuana passes the House, but faces a veto threat from Governor Chris Sununu. A bill to ban conversion therapy fails, and the House passes legislation that would provide a paid medical and family leave benefit to New Hampshire workers. These and other pieces of legislation are up for debate this session, and we're happy to be here at the Barley House in the shadow of the State House for our first ever recording of the weekly news roundup before a live audience. We are not taking calls or emails this hour, but we are taking questions from this audience. Thank you to everyone for coming out on this, what feels like a relatively warm day. Here on the stage with me are three people who know the legislature very, very well and will be happy to answer your questions as best as they can. NHPR's Casey McDermott, Trent Spinner, editor with the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Okay, so we're going to talk about a variety of things. First of them, marijuana legislation. The House passed a bill on Tuesday to legalize recreational marijuana in the state. Trent, what does this bill do exactly?
The bill essentially decriminalizes up to 3/4 of an ounce of marijuana, certain marijuana-infused products, and hashish. It passed the House, 207 to 139. It's a pretty good margin. One of the things we're going to be looking at is that the Senate has never passed a bill like this, and that the governor has already expressed, he didn't threaten a veto, but he said, this is not the time to be doing it while we're in the middle of this drug opioid epidemic. So those are a couple of things I think that we have to be watching as reporters to see whether or not this is actually going to pass.
And we actually have some tape from Governor Sununu, who was responding at about the same time the House was voting earlier this week. Here's what he had to say to political reporter Paul Steinhauser.
Why? Are you kidding? We're in the middle of one of the biggest drug crises the state has ever seen. To go to a full recreational marijuana when other states are seeing it, all the problems that has in other states, and seeing the issues it's bearing, it's definitely not something that I'm supportive of right now.
Governor Sununu not supporting marijuana legalization in New Hampshire, and his question was why. Other states around New Hampshire actually have legalized marijuana, and Vermont seems poised to do that. What is your sense of the influence other states have, Trent, on this legislation?
Well, that's right. Vermont just recently, their Senate just passed a bill that would allow up to an ounce of marijuana, recreational use of marijuana. Their governor had previously vetoed it. He had a couple of technical concerns, but they came back with a different bill. It sounds like he's going to pass it. So now we're essentially going to be surrounded by states that allow marijuana, recreational marijuana for adults. And so I think it's from what the governor is saying, it sounds like he is opposed to it, and I guess we'll see what happens. Consider this. I mean, the House passed it with about 200 votes. If he vetoes it, they're going to need to find another 100 votes or so to override his veto, and I just don't know if that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. We have a question. We actually have a few questions about marijuana from folks here in the audience at the Barley House in Concord. Let's talk to Glenn. Glenn, you have a question about marijuana use.
Yes, I do. I hope you can explain a little bit about how any state could actually pass such a law for recreational marijuana when it's against federal law.
Trent Dean?
Well, we've seen a number of states do it. Colorado, Washington State. I think it's also legal now in D.C. Obviously, Massachusetts, Maine. This has been a discussion for a long time. The whole issue of individual states usually driven by some sort of referendum or initiative, voting in favor of it. That's essentially what happened in Massachusetts. I think there are a couple important things to keep in mind. The first thing is public opinion on this is pretty clear. A vast majority of people favor legalization. I think New Hampshire, it's something like two-thirds favor legalization. I saw some data nationally that even a majority, a slim majority of Republicans favor legalization nationally. So this is actually one area where there's a fair bit of bipartisan agreement, and the governor and the state legislature, I think, are a little bit behind the curve. But you see these kinds of cultural shifts. Once they start, you have almost a domino effect. We saw something similar with gay marriage several years ago. So you may see the same kind of tipping in public opinion as the culture shifts. The bill for New Hampshire is really about personal possession and cultivation. It doesn't provide for sale or the building of a retail industry similar to what we've seen in Colorado. And, the larger context to get to your question is that we know the Obama administration had put an understanding in place in the Department of Justice that even though it's still federally a controlled drug and illegal federally, they would not prosecute law-abiding people in the states where it's been legalized. And we now know Jeff Sessions, the current attorney general, has issued a memorandum that gives attorneys, federal attorneys, more leeway to pursue these kinds of issues. I don't know that that's going to happen. This feels to me like, as they say, the proverbial horse is out of the barn. I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for New Hampshire if we were completely ringed by other states that have it. It's probably just a matter of time. So this is a classic states' rights question and a decision by the federal government not to enforce a federal rule.
Casey? I'm sorry. Trying to keep stepping on you, but Casey had a question or comment.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out, though, that in the days since Attorney General Sessions issued his new kind of memorandum on marijuana policy, that has started to have at least a little bit of an effect on the medical marijuana industry in New Hampshire. We've seen several dispensaries that previously allowed patients to use debit cards to buy products from those dispensaries. They've said that they're moving to cash only because of federal policy. So that's an issue that they're running into with their banking institutions, which are dealing with lots of similar entities all around the country that are being affected by this. So that's, to your point, another way that the, kind of whims of federal policy will continue to affect what's going on in New Hampshire.
And Trent.
And we had the same question you did of the U.S. attorney this week. We said, how is this possible if federal law says, and considering what Dean was talking about with the memo from the U.S. attorney general. So we asked the New Hampshire the person in charge of enforcing federal law in New Hampshire, John Farley, he's acting right now, and we asked him, "What are you going to do if there's a marijuana case in New Hampshire?" And he did not rule out the possibility of federal investigators and federal prosecutors jumping in on a case that involves marijuana because it is illegal still on the federal level. So it'll be an interesting thing to watch.
I think certainly politically, if nothing else, I think long term it's a losing issue. If you look at the opinion data, particularly for millennials and younger voters, it's just a non-issue for them. And I think so over time, I think you will continue to see a cultural shift. It may be some years away. It took a long time to get decriminalization through the legislature. It took a long time to get medical marijuana through. But you are starting to see it move pretty quickly in other parts of the country. So, we'll see what the Sessions DOJ does. I think that will be sort of more of a blip in the grand scheme of this pretty major cultural shift on possession and cultivation.
Casey.
Dean, and I think to your point about the status of kind of New Hampshire's status as kind of the lone New England state potentially that will not have legalization. We were in the position of being the lone New England state without a decriminalization statute until just a year ago, and we were having some of these same conversations. So I think that kind of, that there is something to be said for the pressure that is put on the state when all of the states around it have these different laws, particularly when it comes to, how do you enforce possession if people are traveling between state lines? So it's going to be a public policy issue that they're going to have to continue to sort out.
And I think there'll continue to be a healthcare debate about whether or not marijuana is a gateway drug to harder drugs, opioids. It's essentially Governor Sununu's argument is that we're in the middle of an opioid crisis, so we can't possibly legalize marijuana. So he's implicitly making a connection between marijuana and opioid use. So that's something I think that medical profession and scientists will continue to debate as well.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from the audience. Brian had a question about marijuana. Brian.
Yeah, I was just wondering what feedback, if any, have you heard in regard to Governor Sununu's firm stance in regard with the legislature just passing the bill?
Good question. What have you been hearing about folks, perhaps legislators, perhaps saying about Governor Sununu's position? Anything?
I can tell you what we've heard from readers who have written into the union leader. It's pretty split. I think that if you look at polls, there's a slim majority that are for it. And I think that those people are very vocal. And so we've heard from them who say that, you know, Sununu's policy is out of touch, out of date, that type of thing. But we've also heard from policy groups, including policy groups that are focused on the opioid epidemic, who are supporting Sununu, who are saying, yep, this is what you're saying is right, and we're glad you're taking a stance. It doesn't sound like he, and from watching the governor over the last year, it doesn't sound like he's swayed easily by public opinion on stuff like this, especially when he has such a strong stance on it. So it's definitely going to be something to watch.
Yeah, I talked to one of the reporters, Chris Ryan. This is a Chris Ryan and Paul Steinhauser, two reporters here in New Hampshire who talked to Sununu and got that quote out of him. They said he was pretty dead set, that it just was just not going to happen in the middle of the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm. And he's running for re-election this year, and Democrat Steve Marchand is in favor of legalization. To what extent do you think this issue is really going to matter to voters come November?
Oh,
I'm surprising you with this
I
one,
just,
but...
No, I don't want to monopolize the pot discussion.
We want to know, Dean. We want to know.
You know, actually, I just had this conversation this afternoon, because if you look at most opinion data on most important issue facing voters, this is nowhere in the top five or six. It's always jobs, the economy, national security, health care, climate change. You know, marijuana is probably somewhere down below that. That being said, I think, as I said, it's more of an issue for younger millennial voters. I think that there are some people for whom it's very important, single issue voters. And the ultimate question will be sort of, you know, how it kind of moves forward in an issue. In some states, they put it up to a vote of the citizens. Here, we typically do stuff through the legislature. You know, if Steve were to be elected, a lot of it will depend on what the composition of the legislature looks like in 2018.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another subject. Thank you very much for the questions we received from the audience on that. Family medical leave. The New Hampshire House approved a bill Tuesday that would create a family medical leave insurance program in the state. Casey, we'll go to you. So what does this bill do?
So my understanding is that the design of this bill is meant to act kind of like an insurance program where people would pay monthly premiums. I believe it's 5% of... Or
0.5%.
0.5%, excuse me. Yep. That's a big difference. 0.5% of... you know, of their monthly income into this fund. It would be statewide. They could draw from that if they had, you know, if they were having a baby, if they were adopting, I believe, if someone in their family was sick. But there's also a provision for if someone is, if they're seeking addiction treatment, which I think is unique and interesting given the kind of ongoing public policy challenges that we are experiencing in New Hampshire in that arena. So passed pretty successfully in the House with bipartisan support. I think the big question now, as with many of these issues, is what's going to happen in the Senate. There's some, you know, some concern among opponents that it would be unsustainable in the long run and that it would add to kind of the state bureaucracy, because this would be something that the Department of Employment Security would have to oversee to the tune of several million dollars a year. But the argument from supporters is that, look, we need to make ourselves attractive to young families. We need to make this a place that people want to put down roots. And particularly when you have neighbors in Massachusetts, New York, other places kind of, you know, in the general region looking at this, this could be, you know, kind of a make or break thing for people moving to the state.
Trent?
One thing that really interested me with this vote was how bipartisan it was in the House. This is an issue that has been around for a very long time. And anyone who's had a child or raised a family in New Hampshire, you know, there's really no safety net. This, like Casey said, would be a 0.5%. And depending on who you talk to, you know, the supporters of this call it an insurance. People who are opponents call it a tax or a fee. And so I was surprised to see how well it did in the House. And I think there's been a lot of work done on it in the Senate, in the state Senate, especially from Democrats. The governor said that he wasn't really for it and he wasn't really against it. He said that they were kind of going to look at it. So I think if it passes the Senate, it will again come back down to whether or not the governor chooses to veto it. It wouldn't have, again, it wouldn't have enough support in the House to, they wouldn't have enough support to override the veto. So it'll be a kind of a make or break thing in the Senate, I think.
You know, it's interesting in talking to candidates for basically any New Hampshire legislative office and also the candidates for governor in 2016, and I would ask them, you know, what's one thing you could conceivably reach across the aisle and work with the other party, and they all mentioned this particular piece of legislation. This was like the thing, in addition to, I think, kindergarten, that people seem to generally agree upon, but the devil's in the details. Republicans, I've heard a number of Republicans express concern that at some point that the fund may not be able to support the sort of voluntary opt-in nature of the program because it's not going to be mandatory, so you don't have a broad tax base. And then the concern would be that at some point the state would get stuck with the bill. Now, supporters say there's plenty of money and that any money that comes from the state will be paid back within 10 years. I've heard Republicans say they're not so sure. So it's going to come down to, and Governor Sununu, as we mentioned, has said he likes the idea conceptually. He has concerns about the financial impact on the business community.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about this bill that, as far as I understand, was controversial was the opt-in, right?
Yeah.
It used to be that under how it was originally drafted, it was mandatory.
Right.
But now individual employees can sort of opt in. And one of the concerns was that, well, if you know you have a major event that would require this coming
right.
up.
Right, you can kind of game the schedule. The
yeah,
schedule
you could sign right. up, have that, yeah. maybe you become a parent. And then you have to take that time off to care for your newborn. And then after that, you stop making contributions. Is that a widespread concern? But it is a concern I saw, but is it widespread?
Well, it's interesting. You know, this was actually was just a show on the Exchange Thursday morning talking about this particular piece of legislation. And we heard a different argument. Typically, you hear about family medical leave in the context of having babies and both parents taking time off with an infant. But one of the individuals on the show was arguing that it's actually good for keeping people in the workforce, that you may have workers who are in their 60s and maybe they need some kind of procedure going along with growing older. And this is a way to keep them in a very tight labor market longer, which is another interesting argument. But the whole sort of voluntary opt-in and you pay, was it $5 or something, $250 for a year or something like that, that people may kind of game, as you said, whether or not they get in. So we just don't know. The debate's going to be in committee over the financing of it.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, so we don't know still how the governor feels about that. I suppose we'll find out in good time. One more subject to talk about before the break, and that is legislation that would create a new State Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. This week, Representative Al Baldessaro spoke to the State Veterans Advisory Committee and urged them to support it. This was after it passed, but he's still pretty concerned about whether or not it will pass. Here's how he made his case.
Veterans have no clue where to go in the state. This is why this is long overdue, this bill. I would think every veteran sitting at this table would want not one veteran left behind. And I've seen it too often.
Republican Representative Al Baldessaro speaking on in support of a bill that would create a Department of Military and Veterans Affairs in the state. There's one nationally. There's not one here in New Hampshire. And I'm not sure if this has been a perpetual annual bill. Maybe you know, Dean, if this is something that comes up again and again.
It's a good question. I don't know. Trent, do you know if this is a new proposal by Baldessaro?
If anyone has spent more than 5 minutes with Representative Baldessaro, they know that he cares deeply about veterans and veterans issues. He's a veteran himself. He was the co-chair of the Trump New Hampshire Veterans Committee.
Had been rumored for a VA position as well, I think.
I think there was talk about Al having a pretty senior job at the VA, and he was down at Trump Tower for a number of press conferences about veterans with President Trump during the election. And so I think that this is something that here's his concern, that if you're a veteran right now in New Hampshire, you don't have one central place to go to if you have a problem. And so what he'd like to do is essentially create a commissioner-level position to just help local veterans deal with some of the bureaucracy I think we've seen that veterans have to deal with.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange, live from the Barley House in Concord. I'm speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, also Trent Spinner of the Union Leader of NHPR's Casey McDermott. We're here with a live audience taking a look forward at the legislative session as well as the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and this week we are here recording the show live at the Barley House in Concord. I'm Peter Biello here with Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and NHPR's Casey McDermott. Let's jump right back into the conversation. We'll get to some of your questions as well. We want to start this part of the show talking about the legislation on banning conversion therapy. This House bill to ban conversion therapy was actually killed this week. Let's go to you, Trent Spinner. What exactly would this bill have done? Why was it killed?
So this bill would have prevented counselors from trying to attempt treatments to change a child's sexual orientation or gender identity. There's a lot of controversy on both. There are a lot of opinions, I should say, on both sides. Opponents of conversion therapy say that it is totally ineffective. Proponents of it say that, or I should say, people who were against this bill. That's what I should say. People who were against this bill said it was unnecessary. The bill itself was unnecessary. The ban was unnecessary because there are no proven cases of this even happening in New Hampshire. And they also talked about religious freedom. And they just basically said, kind of the live free or die argument. So it ended up in a tie vote in the House.
It was really close.
It was 169 to 169. And in New Hampshire, what happens there is the Speaker of the House gets to break the tie. The Speaker decided that he was against the ban and voted it down.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the argument to counter what you just mentioned, which was that, hey, there's no one practicing this in New Hampshire anyway, so why bother ban it? What's the answer to that?
The answer is that conversion therapy can sometimes be, there have been cases outside of New Hampshire where conversion therapy has been pretty gruesome. Some things that have happened that aren't legal anyway, but people who want the ban say that, even though it hasn't happened in New Hampshire, because it has happened in other places, because it can be gruesome, because it has been proven to be ineffective, it should not be allowed here at all.
Okay.
Also,
Casey?
It's worth noting that the American Psychological Association, Psychiatric Association, other medical groups have said that it's not only ineffective, but can cause long-lasting harm to kids. So I think the argument to counter that as to why are we trying to ban this if we have no proven cases is why not try to ban this thing that we know is harmful.
And it's based on a very controversial idea that your sexual identity, your gender identity is not determined at birth. It's something that you can be converted into or out of, which I think has been largely discredited by a lot of people who study this stuff. And it has had really traumatic results in some cases. And so that's the argument, is that it's based on bad science, and it can be abusive.
Mm-hmm. That bill killed this week. We want to get a question in from our audience. Let's talk to Bruce. Bruce, you had a question about something. Let's hear it.
Yeah, my question concerns the Trump administration's announcement to open up U.S. waters on the East Coast to oil exploration. This announcement was later amended by the Trump administration by removing coastal waters off Florida from inclusion because it's, coasts are heavily reliant on tourism as an economic driver. And what I'd like to know is, what is New Hampshire doing to oppose the oil exploration off its coast? Our coastline might be small, but it certainly is a cherished treasure that should be protected in every way possible from the risk of commercial oil exploration.
Bruce, thank you very much for the question. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a great question. It's actually something I've been familiar with for many years. We've been preceded with an earlier decision to open up drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve. I worked at a big law firm in Washington right after college in the mid-'80s as a legislative aide, and the hot topic then was drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve. So these issues have been with us for a long time. The drilling off the coast of the United States, as we know, Donald Trump is not a big fan of alternative fuels. He wants to his belief is that you can bring back the coal industry and build the fossil fuel industry, natural gas through fracking, et cetera, and that there are these untapped reserves off the coast of the United States. This is going to be a big political football because there are a lot of governors and senators in their states. Florida, we've already seen them. Secretary Zinke do a carve out for Florida because Rick Scott, the current governor of Florida, I think is thinking of running for Senate, and he was very upset about this, and they don't want to lose him as a candidate. Governor Sununu has spoken out against it. I just saw blanking on his. Down in the Carolinas, one of the members of Congress talk about how they don't want it. So this is going to be this may be something that certain parts of the energy industry and some parts of the Republican Party like. But given how important tourism is to a lot of these states, I think you're going to see a lot of pushback and pushback from Republicans as well. So they're going to try to do this. I'm skeptical that you're going to suddenly see lots of drilling off the coast of a lot of these states.
Bruce, thanks again for the question. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're broadcasting from the Barley House in Concord this week. Let's talk about another story that's been sort of brewing over the past few months and culminating in something new this week. This week, a note went out from the State House to lobbyists telling them that they should know that they are covered by the legislature's sexual harassment policies. Let's go to NHPR's Casey McDermott for this, because you've been reporting on this quite a bit. Why did the State House feel compelled to contact lobbyists and tell them this?
So this note, to my knowledge, actually went out last week, and it went. It was addressed by Senate President Chuck Morse and House Speaker Sean Jasper, so the two top leaders of both chambers in the State House, and it basically said to all registered lobbyists in the state, you need to know your rights. You need to know that when you walk into this building, you have every right to expect a safe work environment, just like any lawmaker or anyone else who walks through the doors. And they felt the need to articulate that because they felt like from either reading press reports or having conversations with people, that point had not been clearly understood before, that there was some kind of sense that, well, you know, if I'm a lobbyist, I'm not technically part of this institution, so am I really covered by this? So they wanted to make that clear, and they also included in the letter a copy of separately from the letter, a copy of the State House's harassment policy. And they also included the contact information for all of the people who are designated to receive reports. So the chiefs of staff of the respective offices, Legislative Ethics Committee, other officials. So I think the goal was really to make sure they spelled out as clearly as possible. We want to hear from you if you run into an issue, and we want this to be a safe work environment.
Mm-hmm. So let's say a lobbyist does run into an issue. They make that phone call. What then happens? Is there an investigation?
It depends. It is handled, my understanding, on kind of a case-by-case basis, depending on the nature of the incident and also the nature of who's involved. My understanding is that they generally try to keep the complaints to not publicize them more than they need to be publicized to protect people's privacy who's involved. But there are two separate paths. You could report either to, as I said, the office of whatever lawmaker may or may not be involved, or you could report it to the Legislative Ethics Committee, and they have their own kind of investigative procedure. Although I will note that based on some reporting I did a few months ago, I was told that the Legislative Ethics Committee has actually never adjudicated an issue of sexual harassment. So they've not received and actually gone through the policy procedure to look into one. So it's kind of uncharted territory right now.
Okay. Let's talk about another story that you covered recently, Casey, and that's that there are 20 new transitional housing beds between two organizations in New Hampshire now. The approach being taken now is more than just adding capacity. That's what you were reporting on. So what's happening, Casey?
Yeah, so just to kind of set the stage here, New Hampshire has been dealing with really chronic issues with its mental health system for a while, and we see this in the form of dozens of people all across the state having to wait in ERs because there's not enough room either at the state psychiatric hospital or other institutions that are designated as places where they can receive, you know, intensive care for a mental health crisis. So the shift that the state has been trying to make over the last few years is to build capacity in the community. But one of the issues that they were running into is that, you know, say someone is staying in New Hampshire Hospital there's not a lot of places for them to go to have a safe place to kind of transition in between life in that very kind of controlled environment where they're receiving intensive care and the rest of the world. So this is meant to be a bridge between that environment and their day-to-day life after their hospital stay. And the idea is that they're going to add 20 beds total, so 14 beds in Nashua, 6 beds in Bradford. They're going to bring 20 more online. That's the goal by the end of next year. And that will allow them to basically have more of a back door, is the way it's described, from New Hampshire Hospital. So people can leave New Hampshire Hospital, have somewhere to go that's safe. They'll help them get on their feet in terms of housing assistance, other social supports, really help to kind of, you know, put all of the things together that they would need to be successful after that hospital stay. And the idea being that, you know, if you free more beds at New Hampshire Hospital, that will allow more people who have been waiting in emergency rooms to seek treatment there. So it's you know, one small part of this system, but they officials seem to think it's a really important one.
Mm-hmm. And help us understand the scope of the problem. I mean, how, for someone in crisis who needs one of these beds, how hard has it been in recent years to get one?
It's very hard. So according to NAMI New Hampshire, which is an organization that advocates for people who are dealing with mental illness, earlier this week they posted that on one night, 41 adults and one child were waiting in ER beds across the state. So those are people who are stuck in hospitals in an environment that's really not conducive to someone who's dealing with a mental health crisis because there's really nowhere else for them to go in New Hampshire. So, like I said, the goal is to really alleviate that backlog.
Some progress on that issue. I want to go back to the audience because Judy had a question. Judy, thank you very much for coming out. What's your question?
Isn't it illegal for public funds to be spent or given to religious institutions? I'm thinking about the voucher system in particular.
A voucher system, Judy's question, in case those here couldn't hear it, asking about whether or not it's illegal to give public money to private schools. This was in the news recently. Maybe, Dean, you could help fill us in on the details of what's happening statewide.
Yeah, I mean, this whole issue of school vouchers goes back decades, really, to as far back as the Reagan administration. It's been a very popular issue for many years among conservatives, and it's only really just been since 2016 that kind of the political dynamic is in place for advocates of school vouchers to push for legislation. So, you know, the current legislation, we have these education savings accounts in which parents can choose to send their kids to private school, parochial school, homeschool, and get some portion of what would normally go to the public school to educate their children. Governor Sununu has pressed for some constraints on how and who gets that money in terms of income level and some other criteria in terms of your options as a parent. But traditionally, yes, it has been illegal for that money to be used at religious schools. And my guess is that if this legislation is signed into law here in New Hampshire, it'll be challenged in the courts immediately. Our attorney general here in New Hampshire, who had initially expressed concerns about including religious institutions in this piece of legislation, just recently changed his mind and said he thought it would be okay to move forward. It's still going to be challenged in the courts. I haven't fully digested why he changed his mind. It may have something to do with the nature of the particular scholarship fund that is set up. It's kind of an indirect way of funding these vouchers. But it is the age-old question of whether or not school choice should include state or federal dollars going to religious institutions. It's going to go to court probably immediately if it passes.
This is the Weekly News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR, broadcasting live from the Barley House in Concord. Still to come in this hour, we're going to be talking about the congressional district races that are up for grabs this fall. So stay tuned for that. But right now, we got a few more stories to talk about before the next break. One of them is LRG Healthcare, because they're citing financial challenges right now and in their review of whether they will need to cut or change some of its programs, including its maternity unit. Casey, you've been reporting on this. What is LRG doing?
So they say that they have made no decisions right now as to whether they are going to make any changes to their maternity unit or any other programs. But what happened was earlier this week, they sent out a press release, and I will say that I had heard kind of before they sent this that they had started to communicate either to employees or to other people that some kind of review might be coming. So they issue this press release saying, you know, we're working to meet the pressing financial challenges facing our hospital today. And to do that, we're going to look at whether we can continue to operate in our current form. One of the units that they said is specifically under review right now is their maternity unit. And I talked to their CEO actually the day after that announcement went out, and he explained to me that they're really in a tough spot right now where they are averaging, I think he said last year they had about 280 births. He said that anecdotally as a hospital CEO, he has heard that you need about 1,000 to be financially sustainable. He also said that they have 60% of their births on average are people who are on Medicaid, and the Medicaid reimbursement rates that they're dealing with are way lower than what they need to make up the cost. So he said that they're dealing with about a $7,000 loss on each Medicaid birth. So when you put those two pieces of the equation together, and when you add on top of that difficulty that they're encountering recruiting, retaining staff, like a lot of healthcare institutions in our state, he said that's, you know, really kind of a perfect storm for it to be especially difficult for them to continue operating in their, you know, in their current form. Again, he said he's not telling expectant mothers to seek care elsewhere. I think, you know, if you're pregnant right now and you're expecting in 4 months, it's got to be a tough spot for you because you don't know whether you can count on that being there when your baby's going to be born or afterwards. I will say that this is part of a larger trend that is affecting rural hospitals and rural maternity units across the country. We're seeing lots closed down for similar reasons, but it'll definitely be interesting to keep following up on that and talking to people who might be affected.
Mm-hmm. Well, put it into perspective for us. If they do end up closing and ceasing to offer certain services, how big a loss would that be for that region?
It would be a pretty big loss. So Huggins Hospital closed their maternity unit, I believe, in 2009. That's in Conway. That, at the time, was talked about as a real loss for that region. I believe right now that Speer in Plymouth still has a maternity unit, but otherwise, I think you're left looking at Concord as one of the next kind of closest places for families seeking maternity care. So that's a pretty long drive if you're talking about somewhere from the Lakes region, going even just for a checkup for prenatal care. So that's definitely kind of going to put a crunch on people in that region.
Okay. This week, the governor nominated Maura K. O'Neill as the state's next director of the Office of Child Advocate. So Trent Spinner, the union leader, who is she and what's she going to be doing?
Well, let's just go back and remember why this office was even created. So there were a number of stories about young children, a three-year-old Brielle Gage and 21-month-old Sadie Willman of Manchester, who were in and out of DCYF protection and died. And so after the news coverage of their deaths broke, there was a study to look at what is wrong with our child protection system. And one of the key components of that study was that there needs to be an independent check on that agency. And so they created sort of an ombudsman for DCYF. And that's what Mrs. O'Neill will be doing. She's in charge of essentially being the advocate for children who are in protection, state protection. She has done stuff like this before. She was the assistant advocate in Connecticut. She has a lot of experience. She spent time at Yale, and she is doing something similar in Maine right now. She's coming over to New Hampshire. She has a lot of experience doing this. So this will be the first time the state has had a position like this. And so we'll be watching to see how much leverage she has and how loud she speaks up for children who are being protected by the state.
That's Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. We're also here with NHPR's Casey McDermott and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're here at the Barley House in Concord doing a live edition of the program. We're here with a live audience, and we'll be right back with a conversation about congressional district races. Thanks for tuning in. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and this week we are here recording the show live at the Barley House in Concord. I'm Peter Biello, so happy to be here with you and with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences
at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and NHPR's Casey McDermott. So let's talk about some of the elections, because it is, after all, an election year. Congressional race is heating up. It's a midterm election year, and in New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District, Democrat Annie Custer is running for re-election. Right now, the attention is on those running in the Republican primary. Former state GOP Rep. Lynn Blankenbecker is entering the race this week. Dean, who is she?
As you mentioned, she's a former state rep. She spent time in the Navy. She's now a naval reservist. She's an attorney, I believe, and obviously running in the Republican primary. She's been generally supportive of President Trump. When asked about his temperament, however, she said she didn't want to criticize her commander-in-chief, so she just sort of left it at that. Her argument has been that Congress is dysfunctional, that it hasn't been any better since Annie Custer was first elected. So kind of supporting Trump, kind of arguing that Congress needs to be less dysfunctional.
And who's she going to face in the primary?
Right now, there are two other challenges. There's Steve Negrin, who I think is a first-term state representative from the Nashua area. He's a technology businessman, also a former military Air Force, I think. Stuart Levinson, who was quite well known as for being a whistleblower at the Manchester VA scandal. He's now running as well. So right now, we have three. Jim Lawrence, sort of thinking about, he was the challenger last time, did pretty well, even with a fair bit of political baggage. He's thinking about possibly getting in as well.
And for a candidate to get in the race in January of the year of the election, is there enough time for this candidate to raise enough money, get enough name recognition to be a viable candidate in the primary?
It's possible. I think it's going to be challenging for a variety of reasons. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, before the flood of outside money into New Hampshire, I would have said no way. Now you can get a lot of money into the state quickly, even if you're a relatively unknown candidate, if those outside groups decide they want to play in that particular district. Congresswoman Custer has raised over $2 million already. She's got a nice little war chest. Lynn Blankenbecker has said that, it doesn't matter. She's not going to try to buy the seat. But the reality is you need money to be able to advertise. You need money to get visibility. So it's a challenge. As I said, the biggest wild card now is all the outside money that pours into the state. So as a candidate, you only have to raise a fraction of what you might have once had to raise. The biggest issue, I think, is that for any of these Republicans is it's not a great year to be running as a congressional Republican. Congressional seats in the House are the most susceptible to these kinds of wave fluctuations. You take a look at the first congressional district, Frank Ginta and Carol Shea-Porter are going back and forth over a 10-year period. So I think it's going to be a challenge for any of those folks, in part just because of the way the sort of larger dynamics. But the other issue for them, I think, is that right now, anyway, it seems like there's more interest among national Republican groups in playing in that first CD where it's an open seat than in the second CD where she's now running for a fourth term.
Mm-hmm. And give us the lay of the land in CD2 before we move over to CD1. Is it a solidly Democratic district no matter who's running, or would it be in play were Custer not running?
I think it might be in play. There's no guarantees that she's going to win, but I think it would be more in play in a different part of the four-year electoral cycle. This sort of first term after a new president, particularly a controversial one, is very difficult, I think, for Republicans. That district, this is the district that was held by Charlie Bass for something like 12 years, a moderate Republican. So the district has trended sort of gradually more Democratic in recent years, particularly along the upper, you got Concord, and then you've got the Upper Valley, Hanover, Lebanon, Keene. So it is more Democratic, but I think there's still opportunities for Republicans to play in that district as well.
Okay, now we should talk about CD1, because that's the one everybody's waiting to talk about, right? That's the one where there's an open seat. Democratic Representative Carol Shea-Porter is not running for re-election. So it's wide open. And this week, Deglan McEachran has entered the race. What do we know about him, Trent?
Deglan is a Portsmouth entrepreneur, tech entrepreneur. His dad ran for governor. He is 34, so pretty young. And you got to consider there are a lot of other Democratic candidates in that field, including Chris Pappas, who's also young, entrepreneur, the owner of a very famous restaurant in Manchester. So he's got a lot of name recognition and an executive counselor. So you know this is going to be a tough race. It's I think even tougher than in the second congressional district. I mean, think about that: seven candidates all running for the same spot. It takes a difficult it to get name recognition, to get oxygen in that race. It's going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll have to wait and see who of the 7,000 candidates in that race sort of pulls to the front. But meanwhile, let's talk about Representative Carol Shea Porter, because she's still in office and she's still sort of expressing opinions, notably this week about President Trump. She supported an effort to impeach the president this week. Dean, why? Why did she decide to join this effort?
Well, there's interesting debate within the Democratic Party about whether or not pushing for articles of impeachment in the House is a smart electoral strategy during a midterm election year. She has said she's behind it. I mean, she's got nothing to lose. She's not running for re-election. She'll probably be gone before this ever even were to come to fruition, before we would ever have any. There have been some attempted votes, but...
Not that this is a risky move for Democrats.
Well, some believe it's an overreach. Yeah, some Democrats believe it's an overreach for the party to be focusing on that right now, that it's going to alienate independents and moderates who, they're not they maybe took a chance on Trump and they're not really happy with him now, but they don't want to see the Democratic Party kind of lurch too far to the left either. So, again, this is a debate within the party, and I'm hearing both sides. You know, the reality with impeachment, you probably know, you need a majority in the House for the articles of impeachment, and then you have the Senate trial. You need two-thirds of the Senate to vote for removal from office. So the going into the 2018 midterm, if you look at the Senate map, it's going to be very difficult for Democrats. Maybe they'll pick up a seat or two. Maybe they'll hold their seats. Let's just say, hypothetically, that the Senate flips, and suddenly you have a Democratic House, which seems more likely, and a Democratic Senate that is 51-49. It flips from what it is now. They're still going to need another 16, 17 Republicans to vote for impeachment. I see no sign of that happening now. There could be something that comes up down the road. The things that Carol Shea Porter cited, his handling of North Korea and the emoluments clause because his family is still making money while he's in office, that's not going to drive a movement for impeachment, and certainly not a successful trial in the Senate. There may be something else coming down the road that we don't know about, but it's going to take buy-in from Republicans, much in the same way that it took buy-in for Republicans to tell Richard Nixon it was time to go. So I think that's a long way off. And there is an argument to be made that it's a little counterproductive, as much as it kind of excites Democratic base, that in terms of kind of electoral strategy in some parts of the country, maybe it shouldn't be the first thing you talk about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the Senate, where something did pass and become law, and co-sponsors, Senators Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, supported this. It's the Interdict Act. Dean, this was signed this week. What would this do?
This is more federal dollars for... To Border Patrol, Customs, to have a sort of high technology ways, in particular, of stopping the flow of fentanyl into the country. And it's obviously for all of our borders, but it will certainly benefit New Hampshire. And you may have seen some video of Senators Shaheen and Hassan in the Oval Office as President Trump signed this into law. So this is one example of where they were able to kind of work for something in a very bipartisan way, but it's basically more money to stop the flow of fentanyl across the borders.
And Trent, you had some kind of insider knowledge of what was happening in the Oval
Office? Insider knowledge.
But insider knowledge?
Yeah. But just to kind of give you a taste of how things work in D.C. So the House and Senate passed this bill. As you know, the Constitution gives the president a certain number of days to sign it before it automatically becomes law. Well, this happened on Thursday night. Wednesday night, this was not on the president's agenda for Thursday. It was the last day that he could sign this bill before it just became law automatically. This is a bipartisan bill, right? This allows customs agents to search mail and your bags and stuff for fentanyl. Everyone is against that, okay? So there was no partisan bickering about this. And so the White House called Thursday and basically said, we want to do a signing ceremony in the Oval Office today. So Senators Hassan and Shaheen, who were co-sponsors on the bill, rushed over to the White House. And there's this press conference, I'm not exactly sure what to call it, where they're talking about this. And it's just the whole thing is awkward. Senator Shaheen's trying to talk, and the president's cutting her off mid-sentence. Senator Hassan, I think, gets one sentence in, even though she's a sponsor of the bill. And then there are other people, state reps and stuff from Kentucky. And if you read the pool report of the reporter who, like, this is a White House reporter, doesn't even know who the rep, who these people are standing behind the president talking to, about this bill. So it's just a totally wacky, I think, but typical kind of Washington, D.C. scene.
See, that is insider. We wouldn't have read that in the paper, I don't think. So thank you for sharing that with us. There's one more thing that both New Hampshire senators were involved in this week, which is they held a press conference to announce a Democratic proposal for $25 billion in additional funding to combat the opioid crisis. Trent, what would this money do?
So as you all probably know, as of Friday, the government will shut down in about 8 days because we're going to run out of money. And so there is all kinds of debate happening in Washington right now about what happens in 8 days, whether there's a continuing resolution, whether there's a longer lasting budget. And so what our two New Hampshire senators have said is, we would like to see $25 billion spent over the next 2 years to help fund stuff like the National Institute of Health, Medicaid, all kinds of different programs that are focused on the opioid epidemic. They're also part of other bills and other proposals, including $45 billion over 10 years. And there are all kinds of other proposals. You know, our reps have a different proposal. So everyone's kind of fighting over the next eight days to figure out what is our budget going to look like and try and get as much money as possible for the state of New Hampshire to fight the opioid epidemic.
And that's what this is.
That is.
Great. All right. So last thing we should talk about before we wrap up, and that's the news that we're hearing Thursday today about the work requirements for Medicaid. Casey, you were covering this in New Hampshire as the legislature here was debating Medicaid, and there are some Republicans who have wanted a work requirement for Medicaid for a long time. What's the background there?
Yeah, so actually, as you said, this is kind of on the wish list of Republican supporters of Medicaid expansion, in particular in New Hampshire, for a while. I think it makes it easier for them to get some of the other colleagues in their caucus on board who might be otherwise skeptical of Medicaid expansion moving forward. But just to kind of take a step back, the state has previously applied to get a waiver to enact work requirements in its Medicaid program.
And that work requirements, sorry to interrupt, it would be not necessarily you have to get a job, but you can volunteer, you can go to school.
Yeah, so the fine print varies from state to state. I believe there was a provision for job training, potentially volunteering. And so they applied. They found out last year, last November, I believe, that the Obama administration was denying their application, as it had with every other state that had applied. But, you know, Republican lawmakers, once President Trump was elected, figured, hey, he might be more open to this idea. Let's try again. They actually passed a law last year that asked the state to submit a new application. They did that in the fall. And with today's announcement, there's, I think, a pretty broad consensus that New Hampshire is likely to move forward with its, getting approval from the federal government and then moving forward with trying to enact some kind of work requirements into its Medicaid program. I should note that my understanding is that most people who are enrolled in Medicaid and in Medicaid expansion right now are already working, and this would only apply to people who are, quote, I'm using the language from the waiver, able-bodied adults. I believe there's also a provision to allow people to use enrollment in an addiction treatment program to satisfy this requirement as well. So this is meant to give states some flexibility in how they enact it, but just the sheer fact that they know that the federal government is okay with it right now opens up a lot of doors for Republicans moving forward with that idea.
Okay, so before we wrap up this discussion, I want to ask each of you, we'll start with you, Casey, what stories you are looking forward to or you're interested in covering in the coming months?
So at the risk of sounding like a broken record, I think the Medicaid expansion debate in New Hampshire is potentially one of the most consequential public policy debates that we have on deck this year. Not only are we talking about a lot of money, we're talking about a lot of people. I think 50,000 are covered under the program right now. So just figuring out what might happen with them and what might happen with the program, and also just kind of more broadly keeping an eye on how the state is responding to its mental health challenges and also to just the issue of kind of sexual harassment in this environment that we find ourselves in now.
All right, how about you, Trent?
Well, you guys always ask me to talk about animal stories on this show, so I'll give you a good one. Coming up in the Union Leader, we have a story. There was a national story of a local woman right here in Concord whose service dog was stolen. She was a veteran, and there was this kind of weird story behind all what all happened. Anyway, coming up in the Union Leader, we'll answer those questions. It's a good read. I've had the opportunity to check it out. Mm-hmm. It's a wild story, so check it out.
Animal stories, they always get you, right? All right, how about you, Dean? What are you going to be looking at?
Well, it's an election year, so we got lots of races. The race for governor, state legislature, certainly the congressional races, fundraising reports are coming out. I'm also going to be following the debate in the state over voting rights and the various pieces of legislation that are challenging who gets to vote here and who doesn't. You all saw that this voter integrity commission was disbanded, but I don't think that's the end of the fight, so to speak. So I'm going to be watching that very closely in the state as well.
All right. Well, I want to thank our guests tonight, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Casey McDermott of NHPR. Thank you all very much for sharing your thoughts with us tonight. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio, and we'd like to thank the Barley House for allowing us to come here and host this live discussion with you. Thanks to the audience for your questions. So thoughtful of you to come here ready with questions. We really appreciate it. Our producers are Ellen Grimm, Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips. Thanks to Michael Brindley for helping us put this together, Allegra Boverman for taking photographs, Andrew Perella for producing, R.J. Perkins, of course, our president and CEO, Betsy Gardella here tonight. Thank you very much. Dan Tuohy on social media. We really appreciate it. And thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate you coming out. And this has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.